Almost everyone knows that Dr. King was a courageous Christian minister committed to the nonviolent pursuit of freedom for all people. In this pursuit, he went to jail 29 times. Nothing new so far, but prepare yourself for some stunning surprises. James Earl Ray, a petty criminal who died in 1998 and who, according to the official story, shot Dr. King, in fact, did not shoot Dr. King, even though he pleaded guilty in 1969. That's right, James Earl Ray was not, absolutely without any question, not the killer. This footage of Dexter King shaking hands with James Earl Ray speaks volumes. Dexter and the other members of the King family have persevered ever since Dr. King's death to learn the truth about what happened and to make that truth known. They are convinced Ray was not the shooter. Ray's guilty plea comes about on the advice of a lawyer who approaches Ray and offers to represent him. It turns out this lawyer has connections with the true killers. The lawyer tells Ray that a guilty plea will make Ray famous and help him get off with a light sentence. Always easily led, Ray writes out what he's told to. And by the way, it's a guilty plea, not a confession. These facts are found in a book just out, the best single book on the assassination, An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. On the basis of the guilty plea, Ray is sentenced to 99 years in prison. Ray realizes he's been duped. 3 days after arriving in the penitentiary, he moves for his guilty plea to be set aside and that he be given a trial. But stalling by government officials denies him that for the rest of his life. To his dying day, he insists he did not kill Dr. King. Pepper's book includes a full account of the extensive civil trial into Dr. King's death, held in Memphis, Tennessee in 1999. That there was such a trial may be a surprise to you also. The family's suit names as defendants co-conspirators, both named and unknown. The trial's not about money. The family seeks $100 damages. The trial is about the truth. The trial lasts almost a month. 70 witnesses are heard. A jury of 6 black and 6 white persons takes just 1 hour to arrive at a guilty verdict against, quote, the co-conspirators, consisting of the named defendant, Lloyd Jowers, and those that the defendant named in his response, namely, the United States government, the state of Tennessee, the city of Memphis, and Memphis Police Department, James Earl Ray, Earl Clark, and Frank Liberto, unquote. Earl Clark, now deceased, was the top marksman in the Memphis Police Department. Frank Liberto was a mafia kingpin. Conspirators within the U.S. government, according to the trial and the book, include, quote, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, Richard Helms and the CIA, and the military, unquote. The reason all this information probably surprises you is that the mainstream media effectively boycotted the trial. As Pepper writes, the silence following these shocking revelations was deafening. Like the pattern during all the investigations of the assassination throughout the years, no major media outlet would cover the story. It was effectively buried. Just 6 of the many facts that come out at the trial. First, when King arrives in Memphis, he's taken not to his usual hotel, which is safe for him, but rather to another, and given a room he must reach by an exposed balcony readily visible from dense bushes behind Jim's Bar and Grill across the street, and from various high vantage points. Second fact, a special security unit of black officers assigned to King on all his previous visits to Memphis is told it's not required this time. Third fact, defendant Jowers, former owner of Jim's Bar and Grill, admits to receiving and storing a gun the day before the killing, being handed a still-smoking gun the day of, and disposing of that gun. Fourth, U.S. Army snipers are positioned on 2 nearby rooftops and a water tower, not, as you'd expect, to protect King, but to back up the assassin in case he misses. He does not. Fifth fact, New York Times reporter Earl Caldwell is in a room close to King's. He comes out when he hears the shot. He and others testify for the trial that they saw a man crouching in the bushes behind Jim's Bar and Grill. This man cannot be James Earl Ray. Reliable witnesses see Ray leave the area before the shot is fired. Fact 6. The day after the killing, early in the morning, a City Works crew is sent to cut down and methodically remove the bushes and all debris from behind Jim's Bar and Grill. The order comes from the Memphis Police Department. Whoever killed King, it was not James Earl Ray. He could never have coordinated such a plan or assembled such a task force, and he wasn't at the scene. He is the fall guy. But the trial, in effect, is boycotted by the media. That's why you don't know about it. That's why I didn't know about it until 3 months ago, through James Douglas. King recognized that powerful economic forces stunt history and kill hope. It's important to understand that these powerful forces now include the mainstream media. To study Dr. Martin Luther King's nonviolent quest for social and economic justice as the surest foundation for peace is to recognize him not only as a civil rights leader, but as a man of the hour, even in these troubling days. King's life and death remain important news. A little historical perspective. Here are two important events, each reported and accepted as authentic fact at the time. Each was, in reality, an elaborate deception planned at the highest levels and executed to sway public opinion. August 2, 1964. In the Gulf of Tonkin, North Vietnamese torpedo boats attack the U.S. destroyer Maddox. The Associated Press story, for some reason, is datelined Pearl Harbor. The lead. Three PT boats, identified by Secretary of State Dean Rusk as North Vietnamese, attacked. Later, a second U.S. destroyer is attacked. Although no U.S. sailor suffers a scratch, the American public is outraged. President Lyndon Johnson goes on television to ask the country to support war action. 2 days later, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution is approved by the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously, then by the Senate, 88-2. The resolution becomes the entire justification for the United States war against Vietnam. Before that's over, 58,000 American soldiers and almost 3 million Vietnamese die. One small problem. There never were any PT, patrol torpedo, boats. The events never happened. As Secretary of State Rusk, the President, and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara knew. They knew because they planned the deception. One source for this is former Admiral James Stockdale in his book, In Love and War. On the night in question, Stockdale was at the controls of a Sabre jet flying cover for the two destroyers. He saw nothing. Another source is Ben Bradley, much respected former managing editor of the Washington Post. Bradley, in a public lecture in England in April 1987, states, "The so-called facts behind this critically important resolution were quite simply lies." August 2, 1990. Iraq attacks Kuwait, claiming the Kuwaitis are slant drilling into Iraq's oil fields. U.S. President George Bush pushes for a land war against Iraq, but polls show the U.S. public is split 50-50 on that idea. Then comes this eyewitness testimony before a congressional committee from a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl who cannot be identified for fear of reprisals.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
The U.S. public is outraged. Support for land war zooms. It's a turning point. Desert Storm is launched. 135,000 Iraqis are killed. Large numbers die since from sanctions still in effect. One small problem. There never were any incubator baby deaths. Not one. The CBC's The Fifth Estate reveals the girl was the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, given her lines and coached in acting by the giant PR firm Hill & Knowlton. This was one phase of a $10 million joint U.S.-Kuwaiti campaign of deception. This man is lying.
I myself buried 14 newborn babies that had been taken from their incubators.
This man is lying.
They had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
There were a lot of people in on what can fairly be described as a conspiracy of fake organizations, false documents, fraud, and disinformation. Now fast forward to a week ago Sunday. I'm watching CBC television news. The Israelis have easily intercepted a ship, for some reason, crammed openly with munitions. I'm thinking, this is fishy. Now something rare happens.
It's almost impossible that this ship would have escaped detection.
I mean, the thing is bizarre.
It's crazy, and it looks like the whole thing was a setup of some sort.
Another surprise. The Globe and Mail finds the event particularly odd and quotes a widespread Palestinian view that there's something deeply suspicious about the hugely publicized interception. Now, I'm not saying I've got inside dope to prove or disprove the munitions caper. I am saying governments concoct elaborate deceptions for political ends. I am saying that the media have been suckered many times.
Part 2 of Perspective on 9/11 consists of excerpts from three 9/11 videos. I strongly suggest you see all of these videos in their entirety, as these excerpts do not do full justice to all the information contained. The first video is titled The Great Deception. It was made by Canadian journalist Barry Zwicker.
For 4 months, I've been waiting in vain for the North American media to pursue questions about the startling events of September 11th. Here's what I want to know. The multiple hijackings are unprecedented. The first occurs at 7:45 in the morning. It's a full hour before the first plane hits the World Trade Center. But it's an hour and 20 minutes, and after the second plane hits, that the president allegedly becomes informed. Think about that. Then he gives no orders. Why? He continues to listen to a student talk about her pet goat. Why? It's another 25 minutes until he makes a statement, even as Flight 77 is making a beeline for Washington, D.C. In the almost 2 hours of the total drama, not a single U.S. Air Force interceptor turns a wheel until it's too late. Why? Was it total incompetence on the part of air crews trained and equipped to scramble in minutes? Well, unlike the U.S. Air Force, I'll cut to the chase. Simply to ask these few questions is to find the official narrative, frankly, implausible. The more questions you pursue, it becomes more plausible that there's a different explanation. Namely, that elements within the top U.S. military, intelligence, and political leadership, which are closely intertwined, are complicit in what happened on September the 11th. Why U.S. complicity, you ask? Well, to stampede public opinion into supporting the so-called war on terrorism, to justify a war on Afghanistan for a future oil pipeline, the grab for Middle East oil and big budget increases for the military, and the general drive for global domination by the American empire. I know it sounds incredible, but here's some historical context from this book, Body of Secrets. Its author is James Bamford. Bamford, until recently, was Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. I learned of this book on ABC's website. Bamford's information comes from interviews with, for instance, the former dean of the U.S. intelligence community and from government documents. It takes 80 pages to list Bamford's more than 600 information sources. Here's the story. It's 1962. John F. Kennedy is U.S. president. Robert McNamara is Secretary of Defense, and Admiral Lyman Lemnitzer heads the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. The CIA has failed in its illegal Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. JFK decides, Bamford writes, to back away from military solutions to the Cuban problem. But Lemnitzer, the CIA, and others at the top remain obsessed with Cuba. Writes Bamford, As the Kennedy brothers appeared to suddenly go soft on Cuba, Lemnitzer could see his opportunity to invade quickly slipping away. Attempts to provoke the Cuban public to revolt seemed dead. Continues Bamford, Lemnitzer and the other chiefs knew there was only one option left that would ensure their war. They would have to trick the American public and world opinion. Lemnitzer comes up with Operation Northwoods. We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. Casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation. We could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. An elaborate variation. Create an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft. The duplicate would be loaded with selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft will have been converted to a drone, a remotely controlled unmanned aircraft. The destruction of that aircraft will be triggered by radio signal. The Cubans would be blamed. Finally, another variation is described by Bamford. On February 20th, 1962, John Glenn was to lift off from Cape Canaveral on his historic journey. Lemnitzer proposed that should the rocket explode and kill Glenn, the objective is to provide irrevocable proof that the fault lies with Cuba by manufacturing various pieces of evidence which would prove electronic interference on the part of the Cubans. Thus, Bamford notes, as NASA prepared to send the first American into space, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were preparing to use John Glenn's possible death as a pretext to launch a war. The Operation Northwoods plan shows the Pentagon was capable, according to Bamford, of launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into support. ...supporting a war on Cuba. Can we be sure, therefore, that complicity by the Pentagon in the events of September 11th is entirely out of the question? A common explanation as to why no U.S. military interceptors took to the skies on September 11th until it was too late is that it was simple incompetence. Well, let me deal with the incompetence theory. First, by taking you back to October 26, 1999. That is the day the chartered Learjet carrying golfer Payne Stewart crashes, killing all on board. This from the National Transportation Safety Board crash report. 9:19 a.m., the flight departs. 9:24, the Learjet's pilot responds to an instruction from air traffic control. 9:33, the controller radios another instruction. No response from the pilot. For 4.5 minutes, the controller tries to establish contact. Having failed, the controller calls in the military. Note that he did not seek, nor did he require, the approval of the President of the United States, or indeed anyone. It's standard procedure, followed routinely, to call in the Air Force when radio contact with a commercial passenger jet is lost, or the plane departs from its flight path, or anything along those lines occurs. 9:54, 16 minutes later. The F-16 reaches the Learjet at 46,000 feet and conducts a visual inspection. Total elapsed time, 21 minutes. So, what does this prove? Well, it proves that standing routines exist for dealing with all such emergencies, for instance, loss of radio contact. All personnel in the air and on the ground are trained to follow the routines, which have been fine-tuned over decades, as the Learjet incident illustrates. For large scheduled aircraft, tracked throughout on radar, to depart extravagantly from their flight paths would trigger numerous calls to the military, especially after two have hit the World Trade Center and now one is speeding toward Washington, D.C. It flies over the White House, turns sharply, and heads toward the Pentagon. Everyone, and I mean everyone, now knows these planes are very bad news. It's been reported on all TV networks for more than half an hour that this is a terrorist attack. Now, Andrews Air Force Base is a huge installation, It's home to Air Force One, the president's plane. It's home base for two combat-ready squadrons of jet interceptors, mandated to ensure the safety of the U.S. Capitol. Andrews is only 12 miles from the White House. On September 11th, the squadrons there are the 121st Fighter Squadron of the 113th Fighter Wing, equipped with F-16s, and the 321st Marine Fighter Attack Squadron of the 49th Marine Air Group, Detachment A, equipped with FA-18s. This information was on the website of the base on September 11th. On September 12th, Andrews chose to update its website. I find it odd that after the update, there's no mention of the F-16 and F-18 fighters. The base becomes, according to the website, home to a transport squadron only. Yet at 6:30 the evening of September 11th, NBC Nightly News, along with many outlets, reported, "It was after the attack on the Pentagon that the Air Force then decided to scramble F-16s out of the D.C. National Guard Andrews Air Force Base to fly a protective cover over Washington, D.C. Throughout the northeastern United States are many air bases. But that morning, no interceptors respond in a timely fashion to the highest alert situation. This includes the Andrews squadrons, which have the longest lead time and are 12 miles from the White House. Whatever the explanation for the huge failure, there have been no reports, to my knowledge, of reprimands. This further weakens the incompetence theory. Incompetence usually earns reprimands. This causes me to ask, and other media need to ask, if there were stand-down orders. September 11th has brought mostly unpleasant changes, including curtailment of civil liberties and threatened perpetual war, all rooted in the official story of what happened on September 11th. Namely, that one evil man and his network are responsible, and that the U.S. military, intelligence, and political establishments were all caught totally off guard. It's the duty of the media and of intelligent citizens to inquire about any anomalies about September 11th. Today's question, what did George Bush know and when did he know it on September 11th?
Bush was first informed of the suicide attacks at an education event in Florida, his face creasing into anxiety. The crisis transformed his presidency.
This image, embedded in the official story, has led the world to believe that when Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, whispered into his ear at an elementary school at 9:05 that morning, it was the first the U.S. president learned that, in his words, America was under attack. But a growing number of people, including the careful researchers at emperorsclothes.com, don't think so. Using verifiable, publicly available information, Ilarion Bykov and Jared Israel, an intrepid Canadian, raise questions mainstream media stubbornly refuse to even acknowledge. Consider, Bykov and Israel say, the words of journalist John Cochrane, who was traveling with the president on the morning of September the 11th, on an ABC special report. Cochrane is speaking to Peter Jennings. Peter, as you know, the president's down in Florida talking about education. He got out of his hotel suite this morning, was about to leave. Reporters saw the White House chief of staff, Andy Card, whisper into his ear. The reporter said to the president, "Do you know what's going on in New York?" He said he did, and he said he will have something about it later. His first event is about half an hour at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. So Bush knew, writes Emperor's Clothes, about the first incident before leaving his hotel. Take other evidence. By 8:20, according to its own official report, the Federal Aviation Authority, the FAA, is fully aware of the unprecedented emergency in the skies. As Bykov and Israel point out, the President of the United States travels with an entire staff, including the Secret Service, which is responsible for his safety. The members of this support team have the best communications equipment in the world. They maintain contact with or can easily reach Bush's cabinet, the National Military Command Center and Pentagon, the FAA. In other words, around 8:46 at the absolute latest, the Secret Service and the President would have known of all four hijacked airliners and that one had hit the World Trade Center. That's two sets of proofs that question the famous whisper in the ear at 9:05. The president tells us he saw the incredible image of the first plane going in. He went ahead with an easily cancelable appointment. Why? He tells us he knew his country was under attack, yet he continued to listen to a student talk about her pet goat and such for another 25 minutes. Why? George W. Bush is acting right here. There are many other facts equally puzzling, at least for anyone still clinging to the official story of 9/11. His schedule and whereabouts had been publicly announced. Why did the Secret Service not whisk him away for safety's sake? Do you think there's anything here that mainstream media should follow up? Have you noticed any such follow-up? Do you find this as incredible as I do? What will it take to snap people out of the hypnotic trance of the official story and start asking questions? Maybe you calling an editor and raising hell. Until the world finds out the truth about what really happened on September the 11th, the world is held hostage to the so-called war on terrorism. And surely it's time to recognize that for what it is, harsh final steps to what the U.S. military terms full spectrum dominance. The less people ask themselves questions about deceit, the more it clears the way for organizations such as the CIA to continue to receive seemingly unending billions of dollars. Taxpayer money used to train terrorists, as the CIA acknowledges it has, to destabilize governments, as former CIA agent John Stockwell writes in his book, In Search of Enemies, and to inject toxic gray, white, and black propaganda into the world's information systems, as William Bloom spells out in Killing Hope, all with barely a whisper of dissent. Those stratagems include a relentless outpouring of myths about weapons, strategy, security, enemies, history, and human nature from government bureaucracies and adjunct think tanks and co-opted media and electronic theologians. No realm of public policy is more corrupted by untruthful speech than national security. Today, the big lie of the so-called war on terrorism, itself firmly based on the linchpin of the implausible official version of what happened on September 11th, is an even more severe test of truth, in my opinion. Under the banner of the war on terrorism, George W. Bush, with the aid of the media, zealously promotes perpetual global war in service of resource looting and permanent popularity for himself. There's unprecedented militarism. The USA is spending more than half its budget on wars past, present, and future, according to the Center for Defense Information. Peace is not a thing of weakness. It calls for heroism and action. Day by day, you must wrest it from the mouths of liars. You must stand alone against the multitude, for clamor is always on the side of the many, and the liar has ever the first word. The meek must be strong.
In September 2002, I further annoyed our government by releasing my book, Painful Questions. It provides evidence that both World Trade Center towers and Building 7 were demolished with explosives that were placed in the buildings before the attack. I also show that many of the phone calls from the passengers appear to be fake in order to deceive us into believing the airplanes had been hijacked by Arabs. I show that the terrorists were patsies in this incredible scam.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
Building 7 was a 47-story building with a steel frame. No airplane crashed into it, nor did the towers fall onto it. However, this building disintegrated on September 11th. This satellite image shows the World Trade Center about a year before the attack. Building 7 is the tall building at the top. Here is a view from an airplane of the rubble of Building 7. The pile is very small. How did a 47-story steel building crumble into such a tiny pile of rubble? Our government believes that fire caused it to disintegrate. Fires erupted in Building 7 about 9 in the morning, a few moments after the plane crashed into the South Tower. The fires burned all day. This photo shows the fires at 3 p.m. The fires are not easy to see because they are small, and there's lots of dust and smoke in the air. There are only a few flames in only a few of the thousands of windows of this large building. Most floors do not have fires, and the floors that do are burning only in a few small areas. Compared to other office fires, these are small. Why didn't the sprinkler system extinguish them? This photograph shows the rear of Building 7. This side of the building doesn't have many fires either. There are no fires anywhere along the base of the building. Despite the fact that the fires in Building 7 were so small that the sprinkler system should have extinguished them, at about 5:30 in the evening, the building suddenly crumbled into a pile of rubble. How did a few little fires cause Building 7 to crumble? According to Bill Manning, editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering, a magazine for fire departments, fire has never destroyed a steel building. So how did a fire do what it had never done before? Perhaps you wonder if incompetent architects designed this building with delicate steel beams. If so, take a look at the beam with the numeral 7 spray-painted on its end. To say the beams in Building 7 were massive would be an understatement. This building was straddling an electrical substation for the city, so it had some of the thickest steel beams of any building on the planet. At the upper left corner is a standard I-shaped beam. It would be considered massive in most buildings, but it seems delicate next to the biggest beams of Building 7. As is typical in the design of buildings, bridges, and most industrial products, Building 7 was designed with more strength than it actually needed. So how did a building with such massive steel framework disintegrate into such a tiny pile of rubble from a few tiny fires? A government agency, FEMA, conducted an investigation into why the buildings in the World Trade Center collapsed. However, the editor of Fire Engineering magazine became so disgusted by the investigation that the January 2002 issue carried an angry article in which he accused the investigation of being a half-baked farce. Later that month, both Bush and Cheney asked Tom Daschle to limit the investigation. Apparently, a half-baked farce was more of an investigation than Bush and Cheney wanted. I suppose they would have preferred a quarter-baked farce. In March 2002, the Committee on Science of the House of Representatives held a meeting to investigate the investigation. There were more insults and accusations at this meeting. For example, Congressman Bollert complained that the investigation seems shrouded in excessive secrecy. Professor Corbett complained that they were trying to run an investigation with part-time engineers and scientists, and on a shoestring budget. There were also accusations that landlords and insurance companies interfered with the investigation. It seems that a lot of people were helping President Bush ruin the investigation. During April 2002, the final bits of rubble from the World Trade Center were removed. The thick pieces of steel were sold to foreign nations as scrap metal, and at a very low price, while the less valuable pieces were shipped by barge to be buried. By May 2002, the World Trade Center had been cleaned up, and all the rubble destroyed, so nobody could conduct any further investigations into how the buildings collapsed. The editor of Fire Engineering wrote months earlier that this destruction of rubble is illegal. He pointed out that our laws demand rubble be saved from major disasters so that we can learn what happened and improve our buildings and fire prevention techniques. Our government violated the law when it destroyed the rubble from the World Trade Center. In May 2002, FEMA released the report on the collapse of the buildings. Not surprisingly, the report doesn't explain anything. For example, rather than explain how the fires caused Building 7 to collapse, the FEMA report has this. The specifics of the fires in Building 7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. Our government spent 7 months investigating the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings, and at the end, they announce they have no idea what happened to Building 7. If FEMA was a private company, I would demand my money back. Since they are a government agency, their worthless report is evidence that they are involved in covering up a scam. FEMA claims that they cannot understand how Building 7 collapsed, but perhaps you and I can figure it out by watching the videos of it collapsing. Incidentally, this video is lousy because it comes from people who recorded the TV news. As with the security video that shows Flight 77 crashing into the Pentagon, nobody wants to provide good quality video of Building 7 as it collapses. At the top of Building 7 is a rectangular penthouse that contains air conditioning and other equipment. If you recall, the fires were on the lower floors, not near the roof. However, the penthouse is the first part of the building to collapse. How could the fires cause damage to the penthouse without damaging all the floors in between? Here's a different view of the collapse. And another view. Since fire has never caused a steel building to crumble before, I guess we'll never know if this dust is typical. Now that you've seen how the building collapsed, do you think these tiny fires were responsible? If so, how did the fire destroy the entire steel structure? Building 7 collapsed in the same manner that demolition companies destroy old buildings. They use explosives to shatter the joints holding the steel beams together. The explosives are detonated in a sequence that causes the building to fall vertically downward into a tiny pile of rubble. Also, when the building is tall, the explosives are often timed to destroy the interior of the building before the exterior walls are broken, thereby causing the interior section to fall first. As the interior pieces fall, they pull the exterior walls towards the interior. This creates a small pile of rubble with the exterior walls laying on top of the rubble. Photos of the rubble from Building 7 show exactly that, namely the exterior walls on top of the interior pieces. Normally, if a 47-story steel building crumbled into a pile of rubble because of a couple of tiny fires, people around the world would be shocked and want to know what happened. Architects would be interested in understanding what happened so that they could design buildings better. People who live or work in tall buildings would wonder, can fire do this to my building? However, are any architects asking why Building 7 fell down? Are any people in tall buildings wondering if their building might also fall down? Why does nobody care that a steel building disintegrated for no apparent reason? Part of the problem is that most people simply don't know much about Building 7 due to the incredible secrecy surrounding this building. We were frequently told of the evilness of Osama and Saddam, but how often did you see the collapse of Building 7? How many articles did you find in newspapers or magazines about Building 7? The only explanation for this secrecy that I can think of is that nobody can explain how Osama caused Building 7 to collapse. By keeping this issue a secret, they are hoping that people will forget about the incident, rather than ask, what happened to Building 7? One possible reason for the secrecy about Building 7 is that it may have been the control center for demolishing the World Trade Center. The 23rd floor of this building was given $15 million worth of renovations to make it into an emergency command center for Mayor Giuliani. For example, it was given bullet and bomb-resistant windows. This particular office had its own air and water supply, and it was designed to withstand winds of 160 miles per hour. To make the situation more suspicious, the reinforcements were only for this one floor, so that meant most of the building was just an ordinary office building. Why would they protect only one floor? Furthermore, why would they need their own air supply? And how about the protection from 160 mile per hour wind? Well, consider that when the towers fell down, clouds of dust and grit were thrown outward at a very high speed. The only people protected from that blast were in this special emergency command center. Of course, the city government claims the entire building was evacuated at 9 in the morning, so nobody was inside this special reinforced bunker when the towers collapsed. This meant that the city spent $15 million to make this special reinforced bunker, and then everybody abandoned it just when it would have been useful. But did everybody really abandon Building 7? It would have been a great place for people to supervise the attack because the 23rd floor provided a wonderful view of the area, and the occupants were protected from the dust and debris. To make the situation even more suspicious, as I explain in more detail in the book, the flight paths of the two airplanes that hit the towers appear to have been on a course towards Building 7, as if this building was broadcasting a homing signal. The towers were built by the government, so taxpayers owned both of them. However, somehow the government was convinced to lease the towers for 99 years. Larry Silverstein became landlord on July 24th, less than 2 months before the attack. He then had control of the maintenance and security departments, and he began to replace security personnel. Silverstein brought Frank Lowy into the deal to become landlord of the underground shopping mall. Lowy is a billionaire who owns shopping malls in several nations. After the towers disintegrated, Silverstein demanded insurance companies pay him twice what the policy stated on the grounds that each tower was a separate attack. What a coincidence that after these guys got control of the World Trade Center, Osama decided to destroy the entire complex. Joe Valvano, a researcher of the Kennedy assassination, points out that most people believe in coincidence theories, because they explain everything as being due to coincidence. For example, most people believe it was coincidence that all four hijacked airplanes were 80% empty. That Todd Beamer decided to spend his last 13 minutes of life talking on an airplane phone to a stranger rather than his pregnant wife. That fire pulverized three steel buildings, even though fire never did such a thing before or after. That terrorists hit the empty section of the Pentagon. How do coincidence theories make more sense than conspiracy theories? Some people consider my book to adequately explain that the September 11th attack was a scam. Not surprisingly, our government never found any evidence that the attack was a scam. Our government never even found a reason for why Building 7 collapsed. Parton and McKinney are examples. However, most Americans ignored or ridiculed both of them, while supporting these two rich kids as they pretended to be world leaders, and these guys as they used the attack as an excuse to bomb Afghanistan. But the primary weapon in this war is deception, mainly through television, but also newspapers and magazines. Although you may ignore the National Review, these types of publications do have influence over the public. These journalists alter public opinion, and that in turn affects your life and your nation. It's easier for journalists to deceive people than it is for a military to conquer them. It ain't difficult to understand that the McVeigh bomb and 9/11 were scams. So how can people get away with such obvious scams? Because America is corrupt beyond your wildest dreams. There are lots of Americans willing to join these scams, and Bush's buddy is also. Americans often boast about our Bill of Rights and our freedom of speech, and they often ridicule the government-controlled media of communist nations. However, the American media is being used like a weapon to manipulate the public and keep them ignorant, often in obvious ways. The American people are being deceived, not educated or encouraged to discuss issues. Furthermore, neither the U.S. government nor the American people put pressure on the news reporters to stop this manipulation and provide intelligent articles. The only pressure news reporters feel is to provide news that is more entertaining than their competition. Hundreds of citizens have tried to help Americans realize that their nation has problems. But none of their books have done anything to improve the nation because most people refuse to consider that they might be correct. Only a small percentage of the population created America in 1776, and only a small number would be needed to change the nation today. The question I wonder about is, does America have enough respectable citizens to turn this nation into something we can be proud of?
Larry Silverstein, the controller of the destroyed World Trade Center complex, stated plainly in a PBS documentary that he and the New York Fire Department decided to jointly demolish World Trade Center 7 late in the afternoon of 9/11. This admission appeared in a PBS documentary originally aired in September of 2002, entitled America Rebuilds. Mr. Silverstein's comments came after FEMA and the Society of Civil Engineers conducted an extensive and costly investigation into the curious collapse of World Trade Center 7. The study specifically concluded that the building had collapsed as a result of the inferno within, sparked apparently by debris falling from the crumbling North Tower.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse. I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Pull is an industry term, which is short for pull down, meaning demolish. New questions about World Trade Center Building 7. Silverstein's startling admission of the demolition of Building 7 seems to explain some of the mysteries surrounding the third tower that fell that day, but many new questions arise. 1. Why didn't the building owner Larry Silverstein and FEMA communicate about how Building 7 fell during the long and expensive investigation? FEMA's report didn't even mention the possibility of the collapse being due to intentional demolition. 2. How is it possible that the perfect demolition of a 47-story skyscraper could have been done in the short time between when Silverstein was on the phone to the fire department and the collapse at 5:25 in the evening? Demolitions take months to design, engineer, and implement. Plus, the building was on fire. 3. Why was pulling down Building 7 the smart thing to do? Because of a terrible loss of life? The building was abandoned, so what lives? How about the lives of the hypothetical heroes that would have had to re-enter the abandoned building carrying high explosives to do months of work in a few hours while the fires that could not be contained were burning all around them? By the way, who are these guys? How come we haven't heard of them? Since the instant demolition scenario is essentially impossible, the only other plausible explanation is that demolition explosives had to have been installed and wired before 9/11. By admitting to the demolition, Silverstein also eliminates the possibility that terrorists could have planted the explosives. Together, these two points dispute the official story of 9/11, which is based on the assumption that the attacks were a complete surprise and done by Al-Qaeda. Narrated by hip-hop legend Paris and featuring interviews shot by GNN producers in six cities, Aftermath features nine people answering 11 of the most pressing questions that emanate from the terrible and as yet unexplained events of that day. As you will see, These are questions that continue to overshadow and critically challenge the official version of the story.
In the weeks leading up to the one-year anniversary of 9/11, GNN approached nine people who have dedicated themselves to investigating how and why the United States was attacked that September day. We asked them 11 questions. Unanswered question number 2, what did the Bush administration know and when? Mike Ruperts from The Wilderness was one of the first independent news sources to raise the issue of government foreknowledge.
First of all, it's imperative to note that the Bush administration is absolutely and totally lying when it says, golly gee, we had no idea that aircraft could have been used as weapons of mass destruction to attack the United States. We know, of course, that Bush had clear briefings that Al-Qaeda might be hijacking airplanes, but gee, the press forgot to tell you that on October the 24th through the 26th of 2000, the Pentagon held detailed drills practicing for an airliner being crashed into the Pentagon. The major media didn't tell you that at the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy in July of 2001, just 2 months before the attacks, all the airspace was closed off. The summit conference area was ringed with anti-aircraft guns, and the Los Angeles Times reported clearly that Egyptian intelligence and other intelligence services were afraid that hijacked aircraft would be crashed into the G8 summit to kill President Bush. It's a total lie that the administration had no knowledge. It's also a lie that the administration had no advance warning of the attacks. Intelligence reports from France, from Germany, from Russia, from Egypt, from Jordan, all of which taken together, show clearly that the United States government had been warned that in the week of September the 9th, commercial airliners would be hijacked and crashed into the World Trade Center, that those airliners would probably come from at least the one airport in Boston, and that ultimately, through other warnings, that they would involve aircraft from American and United Airlines. Those are very specific warnings, and that's just what we know now to this day.
The FAA, NORAD, and the U.S. military have standard operating procedures that are routinely deployed during hijackings. Unanswered question number 3. Why wasn't the U.S. military able to intercept the hijacked planes? Nafiz Ahmed's book, The War on Freedom, is one of the most detailed investigations of 9/11.
Standard operating procedures dictate that as soon as a plane flies off course, the FAA will contact the plane and try to ask them what is going on. If there is a problem or if they cannot establish radio contact, then immediately the FAA will contact the Pentagon, who will, within a matter of minutes, a maximum of 10 minutes normally, will scramble fighter jets to intercept the civilian plane and to analyze the situation and see what is going on.
In his book, Nafiz documents a timeline of September 11th, showing how the attack should have been prevented, intercepted, or terminated. In the case of American Airlines Flight 77, which departed Dulles and was crashed into the Pentagon, the FAA lost contact at 8:50 a.m. However, fighters were not scrambled until 9:24 a.m., a delay of over 30 minutes.
Now, this sort of direct violation of standard operating procedures is inconceivable without some kind of high-level government approval. If we try to explain it by using the incompetence theory, it doesn't make sense. For example, if it was incompetence, we would expect that there would have been a normal inquiry into what went wrong. We would have expected that there would be some kind of reprimands, that certain officials would be downgraded, or they would lose their jobs, or something would have happened to correct the situation. But we find that there has been no such reprimands at all.
Unanswered question number 4. How did the administration respond to the failures of the military and intelligence agencies on 9/11? Despite the breakdown under his acting leadership on September 11th, General Richard B. Myers was promoted to chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest military post in the country. Unanswered question number 5. What ties, if any, did the U.S. government and intelligence agencies have with the terrorists or their supporters? Michel Chosedowski's research at the Center for Research on Globalization has exposed links between the Bush administration and the terrorists.
The man who, according to the FBI, is considered to be the so-called money man behind the 9/11 terrorists, I'm talking about the head of Pakistan's military intelligence, Mohammed Ahmad.
In the aftermath of 9/11, the FBI confirmed that General Ahmed, then head of Pakistan's ISI, had authorized a $100,000 wire transfer to Mohammed Atta, the alleged ringleader of the terrorist hijackers.
Well, this same individual was on an official visit to Washington from the 4th to the 13th of September, and he met Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, George Tenet, his counterpart. He has links with the terrorists, he has links with the Bush administration. He's buddy-buddy with George Tenet, he's buddy-buddy with Mohammed Atta.
Unanswered question number 6. Were there plans for a war in Central Asia prior to September 11th?
This war was coming for a long time. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who had been Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, but who also worked in intelligence roles for Presidents Reagan and Bush I, co-founder of the Trilateral Commission. He wrote a book in 1997 called The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. And in three specific places in that book, he says the key to America's control of the world in the 21st century is the control of Eurasia.
In support of his thesis, Brzezinski states, a power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions and about three-fourths of the world's known energy resources.
And then he says that without an attack on the order of Pearl Harbor or without a direct external threat, there was no way that the American people would support the imperial mobilization necessary to control Central Asia. And in this book, again, written in 1997, Brzezinski had a map of where the next world conflict was going to be. And you look at this map in the book, and it's exactly where we're fighting now.
Unanswered question number 7. Is there an underlying motive, besides the war on terror, for the U.S. military presence in Central Asia? Peter Dale Scott has written extensively about hidden agendas in U.S. foreign policy.
There are people in the administration who believe out and out that this is the American century, that it is the time for American hegemony. Both Republicans and Democrats have said we shouldn't worry so much about what our allies think.
Despite a lack of support from America's traditional allies, the Bush administration continues to pursue military action in Central Asia.
But it's, I think, pretty clear now to everybody that America has a oil geostrategy in that part of the world.
The U.S. National Energy Policy Report of 2001, authored by Vice President Dick Cheney, formerly one of America's richest and most powerful oil industry executives, demanded a priority on easing U.S. access to Persian Gulf oil supplies.
America needs to control the world oil system. And the fact that we have put U.S. troops in Georgia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, even in Kyrgyzstan, 200 miles from the West Chinese border, all those troops there are nominally in the name of fighting the terrorists, but in reality, they have established an American presence in the great oil basin of the Caspian.
Unanswered question number 8. Is there any historical evidence to suggest that the government may have used the 9/11 attacks to justify its war in Central Asia? Alex Jones is a television and radio broadcaster who has publicly questioned the Bush administration's version of what happened on September 11th.
Governments always get caught engaging in terrorist attacks against their own populations to rally them for war or for a domestic crackdown. We saw William McKinley's Navy in the 1890s blowing up their own ship in Havana Harbor as a pretext for war with the Spanish government. And that's now admitted fact. We saw Adolf Hitler blow up his own Reichstag as a pretext for martial law. Firebomb their own capital. Nazi documents have been released, now a part of historical record. Then, of course, we saw December 7th with the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. It's now been released that 12 days before, they had Admiral Yamamoto's communique that the Japanese were going to be attacking Pearl Harbor. One of the best examples we have of the U.S. government planning terrorist attacks against its own institutions is the North Woods document. This is a confirmed, admitted document, declassified just a few years ago.
In Body of Secrets, his best-selling expose of the National Security Agency, author James Bamford revealed that Operation Northwoods called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., and for a U.S. ship to be blown up in Guantanamo Bay, all in an effort to galvanize American public support for a war against Cuba.
And they say in the Northwoods document, casualty list in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of indignation. We certainly saw a helpful wave of indignation after September 11th.
Unanswered question number 9. How has the government's reaction to the terrorist attacks impacted the rule of law in the United States? John Judge is a member of the Washington Peace Center and has researched the post-9/11 effects on U.S. civil liberties.
As of September the 11th, the entire country went into continuity of government, which is a special government that does not rely on the elected representatives, but in fact puts a small group of people in power. When you go into a declared war or a state of national emergency, which is what they went into on September 11th, legal authorities change. Hundreds of laws allow new power and new authorities for a select few people. Decisions are made not by the overt government, but by now an acknowledged shadow government. That's who's making these decisions, is DOD, FEMA, and the NSA. That's who's running the country since September 11th.
In conclusion, we asked our interviewees, what are your final thoughts, and what can we do?
The run-up to September the 11th, the historical context in which it occurred, is a much darker, much deeper political and economic story that cannot be explained away by the trite and simplistic explanations given by the administration or the news media.
Is that the American people, separated from their own history, have no idea what has been done in their name all around the world in those intervening 50 years since the end of World War II.
Dissent has never been more critical for us to engage in with all of the energy and all of the commitment that we can muster. Because without these voices of dissent, we will not be the full society that we cherish. And the government is taking us on an illegal path. And it is our voices that must demand that they follow the Constitution and follow the law. When people say what we should be doing, people need to mobilize at the local level, at the grassroots level. There are now about 30 municipalities around the country that have passed resolutions to demand repeal of the Patriot Act. It's a very good thing for people to do. People are also negotiating at the local level with their local law enforcement that local law enforcement should not cooperate with federal law enforcement in terms of INS, or the Department of Justice, the FBI. People need to encourage people to speak out, encourage their local governments to speak out.
As this system squeezes more and more people, as this system begins to dominate more and more people and displace more and more people, folks are going to be looking for answers. You need to be educated to be leaders in your area to give them those answers and how we can rebuild our society on decency and honor and things that have really made societies work in the past. We've got to start honoring creativity, honoring individuality, and not this mass-marketed slave hell that they've created. Now is the time to fight this dehumanization. Now is the time to realize you're special and you have power and you can affect change and that we're in a war for the very future of humanity. It's that important. And you're a soldier on the front line. So get out there and take it back to them 110%. You don't have a choice, ladies and gentlemen. Run your own life or somebody else is going to run it for you.
What happened to Flight 93? The U.S. government insists the plane exploded on impact, yet a one-ton section of the engine was found over a mile away, and other light debris was scattered over 8 miles away. There were at least 6 eyewitnesses who observed a mysterious military-style jet in the area. What's happened to our media? According to William Colby, the former director of the CIA, quote, "The Central Intelligence Agency owns everyone of any significance in the major media. The secret team, the real power structure, the most remarkable development in the management of Americans' relations with other countries during the quarter century since the end of World War II, has been the assumption of more and more control over military, financial, and diplomatic operations at home and abroad by men whose activities are secret, whose budget is secret, and whose very identities, often as not, are secret. In short, by a secret team whose actions only those implicated in them are in a position to monitor and to understand. The secret team is not a clandestine super planning board or super general staff. It is a bewildering collection of semi-permanent or temporarily assembled action committees and networks. NORAD's war game, Vigilant Guardian. On the morning of September 11, 2001, Mr. Fulton and his team at the CIA were running a pre-planned simulation to explore the emergency response issues that would be created if a plane were to strike a building. Little did they know that the scenario would come true in a dramatic way that day. There have been numerous stories in various news sources, such as the BBC and the London Guardian, which indicate that at least 4 and as many as 8 of the alleged hijackers are still alive. Secrecy surrounds the 9/11 investigation. Some embarrassing Bush family connections. Marvin P. Bush, the president's younger brother, was a principal in a company called Securicom that provided security for the World Trade Center, United Airlines, and Dulles International Airport, all three of which were part of 9/11. Government cover-up of 9/11. Bush and Cheney resisted any investigation, then told Daschle to limit the investigation when they were pressured into having one by the victims' families. There has been a major government cover-up. Both the Senate Congressional Joint Inquiry and the Independent Commission were headed by people who should be investigated for their role in 9/11. Their stated parameters were not to find the truth, but to justify an expansion of the CIA and the national security state. Government investigations into 9/11. Taxpayers put out $65 million to investigate Bill Clinton's sex life and $30 million to investigate the Columbia shuttle disaster. Why did the Keene Commission initially receive a mere $3 million? Keene is barely better than Henry Kissinger, who had to step down because of his many direct conflicts of interest. Most of the rest of the committee members have their own conflicts of interest, most notably Commission Director Philip Zelikow, who served as the gatekeeper setting the agenda for the commission. According to Max Cleland, a former 9/11 commissioner, Americans are being scammed. Referring to the Bush administration's efforts to obstruct the 9/11 commission's access to critical documents, former 9/11 commissioner Max Cleland called them, quote, disgusting and a scam. Americans are being scammed, Cleland said on CNN's Newsnight. Max Cleland has since left the 9/11 commission because he was appointed by Bush to be on the board of the Export-Import Bank. Whitewash. 9/11 director gave evidence to own inquiry. The panel set up to investigate why the United States failed to prevent the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 was rocked Thursday by the bizarre revelation that 2 of its senior officials were so closely involved in the events they are investigating that they have had to be interviewed as part of the inquiry. The 2 officials are 9/11 Commission Director Philip Zelikow, who has connections to Bush, Cheney, and especially Rice, and Jamie S. Gorelick. Lori Van Auken, who lost her husband on 9/11, asks, did he interview himself about his own role in the failures that left us defenseless? This is bizarre. We entered a looking-glass world on September 11th and we're still in it. Summary of White House cover-up. Then there's the stonewalling about 9/11. First, the administration tried, in defiance of all historical precedents, to prevent any independent inquiry. Then it tried to appoint Henry Kissinger, of all people, to head the investigative panel. Then it obstructed the commission, denying it access to crucial documents and testimony. Now, thanks to all the delays and impediments, the panel's head said it can't deliver the report by the original May 11th deadline, and the administration is trying to prevent a time extension. The PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, a Washington think tank founded in 1997 by a group of influential neoconservatives, or neocons. Most of these people are now major players in the Bush administration. Its stated goal is to promote American global leadership, which they define as full-spectrum dominance. In one 2000 paper entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, PNAC authors wrote that, quote, the process of transformation requires some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. Hence the name of the book, The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. From a skeptical vantage point, but also taking to heart the classic idea that those who benefit from a crime ought to at least be investigated, Griffin, an eminent philosopher and theologian, brings together an account of the national tragedy that is far more logical than the one we've been asked to believe. Inside Job by Jim Mars. The previously titled The War on Freedom was first released by the author. Jim Mars is known for his research and writings on the Kennedy assassination and many other topics. It was re-released in early July 2004 with a new title, Inside Job, from Origin Press. 911truth.org is a newly formed umbrella organization with a great master website.
Planes hit in New York City, and thousands now are dead. It was Arab terrorists, so this is what you said. Well, if that is the truth, then what have you got to hide? What were you doing on the day all those people died? Where were the fighter jets ordered by the FAA?
For 3 days in March of 2004, an unprecedented event brought forth an alternative vision of September 11th. 1,000 activists gathered in San Francisco for Phase 1 of a Citizens 9/11 International Inquiry. This was a culmination of a growing movement seeking to discover and reveal the facts and the truth about the events of September 11th, 2001. The inquiry process will continue with Phase 2 in Toronto at the end of May. The main hall for films and speakers was the historic Herbst Auditorium.
9/11 websites sprung up all over the place, and this amazing sort of conversation and cooperation began happening amongst researchers all over the world.
The films Aftermath and The Great Deception were screened, along with excerpts of Painful Deceptions, Arsenal of Hypocrisy, War and Globalization featuring Michelle Chusadovsky, Liberty Bound, and Guerrilla News Network's Flight 93 and Ammo for the Info Warrior. Along with film showings, a lengthy list of distinguished authorities and activists spoke. The speakers included Carol Brulé, Barry Zwicker, Mike Rubin, Paul Thompson, Ian Woods, Jim Mars, Ellen Mariani, and Phil Berg. Musician David Rovitz added his special energy to Friday evening.
Say when you told the Air Force to stand down, not to intercept, did you plan to let it happen, or are you just inept?
These presenters spoke on a variety of topics, with the common theme of 9/11. Here are some highlights.
The purpose of 9/11 and encore 9/11 type events is to keep the public malleable through fear. A fearful public will countenance a reduction of its liberties in return for promises of greater security. More encores are expected. I hope this will be the subject of much discussion at this inquiry. If the 9/11 planners have been high-fiving over their success, they're engaging in hubris, taking credit where it is not due. Because those who conspired to concoct this toxic trick and inflict it did not succeed because they created a seamless magic trick. They succeeded only because of the virtual total complicity of the mainstream media, our mental jailers. It's from the mainstream media that most people get most of their information most of the time on most subjects. So those who control the output of the mainstream media control the brainstem of our collective consciousness. When those charged with being skeptical inquirers are neither skeptical nor do they inquire, the only phrase for it is deep complicity. As author and activist Arundhati Roy writes in the current issue of Global Outlook magazine, the magazine of our movement, quote, "It is important to understand the corporate media do not just support the neoliberal project. They are the neoliberal project. It is structural. It's intrinsic to the economics of the mass media." But there's another answer to the question. Where are we now and where are we going? I think that now we are actually on the threshold of hope, because such an edifice of illusion embedded in and promotive of an earth-destroying economy is one which cannot be sustained. Something